This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
In thinking about this panel, it was interesting for me with the names and thinking about all of you because it's different points of access or introductions to Julius. So I kind of want you to kind of come from that point of view, and I definitely want you, Tracy, to give more insight to how you approached your performance last night so that people can have a bit of idea of your process and give you a chance to contextualize that as well. Mm.
The process to create yesterday's work was part ephemeral and part just straight intellectual. The intellectual part was I was asked to write some comments for the program, and I did. That's short. But for the performance yesterday, I felt like I couldn't, after hearing Eastman's voice, the first commentary that should come out of the space, at least that I had control over, should be a peer of Eastman's and not me. And that voice that I felt was sort of morally connected to was Samuel Delaney, and that another gay black genius should be the first voice to speak after him, after Eastman. And so he's also a black male genius who's gay, who also spent a lot of time in Philadelphia. So it was just like a little too perfect. And Chip was very generous to allow me to excerpt to some of his comments when I asked him about Julius, and said he gave me his permission to repeat them. So I felt like I deferred to my superiors in a way that would allow me to open up to this space. And I really do feel that, without being too woo, that Julius Eastman's hand is like pulling these strings together. So when we first started talking about doing my potential involvement, I was very happy to do it. And then like a week or two, a couple of weeks before the event, I said, oh, I think I'd like to do something with the piano. What do you guys think? And they were just like, piano's big, got enough to do. And I said, okay. And then it just popped in my head that I should contact my Philly pal, DJ High Priest. And I said, I don't know if you're free, but I'm doing this thing at Julius Eastman. And then I said, in case you don't know who he is, and I sent him all this stuff because he's not. And he said, oh, I'm aware of who Julius Eastman is. And then I found out just before the show that he had done all this research on Julius Eastman 10 years ago. Now, what are the odds that the only DJ that I know in Philly had researched Julius Eastman? And I was like, well, this is Julius Eastman telling us what to do, so okay. Mm-hmm. And I knew a couple of things about the sound part, which was I had problems saying some of the controversial words and that they needed to be said. And the way that you guys redacted some of the terms in the program were very insightful. And so we thought about what would be a jarring way to draw attention to the unspoken without it being said. And then I said something about, in the program, in the meditation, some words are unsayable, but they're not unplayable, or some variation of that. And so we came up with the idea of blasting horns, you know, as a sort of way of framing the human voice. And the other was like to contextualize him in the of the 70s, usage of euphemisms through Richard Pryor, Curtis Mayfield, and others, and Priest found that loop. personally, you know, it got a little deep. And I felt like because I was so nervous about him, about the magnitude of this, I didn't know quite how to manage it. And so I needed the support of someone like Priest to sort of balance this, the magnitude, the weightiness of acknowledging somebody who needed more acknowledgement, you know, a black hero. And so I had to meditate on getting my ego out of the way so that I couldn't personalize how important the night had become for me. And so I did that, and Priest did that, feeling and thinking. And I guess if I had to describe the sound poem, because my sound poems are improvised, they're all improvised, and so I don't quite know what's going to happen. I just try to get out of the way so that I can receive what I'm supposed to be doing. And after we did the performance, I felt that there was a lot of energy around Julius's death in particular, and the way in which he died away from his strength in a way. And I think that that's what began to emerge as I started performing. What does it mean for someone to lose their life in that particular way, in an obscured, occluded way, in a way in which he was towards the end because of a lot of choices and lack of choices that he had made towards the end of his life, eschewed. So there's the choice to be the outsider, and then there's the notion of being pushed aside or being shunned or in variations of that because of the pain that was generated, and how I've been thinking about this a lot. Like the trickster line, we romanticize that concept, like they're free and they go all over the place. But there's a point where they can also fail and they can fall because of this tight walk that they're walking. What does it mean to fall off of it and into the abyss? And so I thought about this notion of the abyss and the abysmal and how we don't get to mourn, you know, how your obituary was written months after he had passed. And so what does it mean to find out when you guys found out that he had died so many months after he died? And that irresolvability felt like it was coming through the house last night, that we needed to sort of say our thank yous and goodbyes in a way that was timed and not just sort of sprung upon us. So that was some of the energy that I was ending up with, but I didn't plan any of that. I didn't plan that relationship, that dynamic. It was just what was coming up and through in this formerly consecrated space with all of this reverberation.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, sure.
Because I kind of felt like you were channeling Julius's process, you know, like from the prelude to the whole, you know, Joan of Arc, that process I was describing to you, and then the concert I was talking to you about today, where he has like these words and he just riffs on the words, and I don't even know if you were aware of them, but if you're consciously doing it or just had kind of intuited that was kind of a process that he used in terms of words and doing improvs around words and just kind of getting to almost this kind of trance-like kind of state.
My sound poetry practice does a lot of weird stuff.
Uh-huh. So it was like a happy synchronicity that you just...
Yeah.
They asked someone who was doing something, because I don't think you knew exactly all of Julius's vocal poetry type things, and then
right.
You just happened to ask you to do it, and it just seemed to really work, and you seemed to be kind of channeling him in a way.
Yeah, well, he was definitely in the house, and I think the setup, just before, like about a half an hour, hour before, I'd seen the poem and some of the blow-up pictures that Tiana had put up.
Uh-huh.
And I think somebody mentioned it earlier today that contributed to, maybe it was you, the idea of memorialization.
No, I didn't bring that up.
Oh, okay. Maybe someone else. And then, also, as I said before, the idea of the percussive repetition, that rapid, made me think, as I said this privately, of someone trying to escape, especially with that title. I thought of, like, you know, this basic human need to escape oppression and running. Mm. And so the steadiness of the beat of feet running away, the pitter-patter of running feet, was, I guess, part of it. So I guess what I'm saying is that the concept of repetition, a black notion of what it means to repeat and run and be free, is embedded in the music already. So maybe in some ways it was just translated into poetry by me, but I wouldn't be surprised if I was just riffing off something he had already been thinking about in a different medium.
Whatever, it worked.
Oh, well, I'm glad you think so. That means a lot. That means a lot.
And thinking about inviting Tracy, it was really a kind of a thought that it's like, you know, Tracy's career, and thinking, and I think I did that in the invite to you, is like, maybe you'll find interest in this because of the different modes of art that you traverse.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe you would be interested, maybe in participating, or hopefully you would be interested, basically because it was like, here's someone who, if Julius maybe had some of the supports, maybe he would have been able to be on a trajectory such as Tracy, because she performs and crosses all these like forms of art that he had an interest in too. So that was our, you know, thought process behind.
Did it ever occur to you? Just occurred to me. Maybe he tried to do too much.
He?
Yeah, Julius. You know, because he tried to be a choreographer, you know, a performer, a composer, a poet, a dancer, a painter. You know, maybe. You know.
I don't know if it was. I can't. I had this. And I'm going to say what I had. I had this conversation earlier. I don't think it's about doing too much. I think it's sometimes about exhausting oneself or finding a place where you are being forced to find another way to communicate.
Or sometimes.
And I think that that's kind of how.
But sometimes it's also, if you do so many things, people assume that you have, like, your support in this other field. And so that they don't, you know, well, you know, he's a composer. We don't have to do anything. Because, you know, I've done sort of multidisciplinary things. Mm-hmm. And, like, people kind of figure, like, you've got your scene going in here, and so you don't need this. And sometimes it ends up being kind of self-defeating because everybody thinks you're so independent and you got all these things going, and you actually end up not having any support in any of the different sort of, you know, fields that you're working in.
Yeah. I mean, but I don't know. There's something to think about in terms of, like, these ideas of support and then success as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm always very interested in challenging people's ideas of success. So, yeah. Like, in just looking at Julius from my perspective, I'm seeing someone who accomplished these things, like who successfully did these things. Maybe we don't have the full access to it, but it's inspiring to see that someone attempted to do these things across these forms at that time.
Well, you know what? You're making me realize also that there was a lot of support for the arts in the 70s. And then, you know, the Reagan era came in and just destroyed it. And yep. Part of the reason that people had art is because they wanted people not to riot. They wanted to find ways in which people could challenge social hierarchies and not destroy things and try to, like, sort of generate, have a more generative and rejuvenating world and worldview. And then it was just like, yeah, now we're not interested anymore. We want to destroy all of that. We want to destroy these social movements. We want to destroy critical thinking. One of the first things Reagan did was cut out, like, requirements for, like, what do you call it? Like, that sort of public, the public, the fairness doctrine, I think it was, in television. You know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Huh? Yeah. That's right. So, like, you just think of, like, the stuff that we had, like, that's when you had things like Schoolhouse Rock and, you know, you had, like, the Dr. Seuss, all of that political critique that was in those Dr. Seuss cartoons.
And news had to be news.
All of that stuff was eliminated. And so I'm mentioning this because of what you said about support. There was this aggressive attack by the right to destroy people like Julius. We should be clear about that. And you think about, you know, Reagan did not support the development of curative and restorative health care for people with AIDS. You know, so Julius Eastman is somebody who managed to survive as a gay, out black man, the scourge of AIDS in the 1980s, but he still was subject to the dehumanizing and uncaring, you know, hostile, violent policies of the Reagan administration that made people like him die.
Amen.
Great point.
Yeah.
Kyle?
Sorry. I said amen.
Sorry, just.
Could you talk a little bit about your relationship with to Eastman, and also a bit more about how you approached writing, I think, the obituary at the time that you did?
Well, I have written dozens of obituaries. It's kind of, I sometimes think that that's a bulk of my literature. I was exposed to and in contact with Julius mostly during years when I was a student from 1974 to 1980, and it was kind of a series of coincidences, because he performed at Oberlin when I was a freshman there. I went to June in Buffalo the next year and saw the famous incident that made John Cage bang his fist on the piano, and then after that I started studying with Peter Gina, who had been one of the creative associates and who brought Julius to I saw Julius several times through Peter. We went through to New Music America when in Minneapolis when Julius performed there, and then for that performance at Northwestern. And then after 1980, I don't think I saw him again except once in line for a concert at BAM in 1989. And I had heard he was living in Tompkins Square Park. I thought, I expected the worst, but he looked remarkably good. And he was. I went up and talked to him, and he seemed fine and in good spirits. So I was hoping that was a sign of a turnaround, that I'd get to write about him again. And that was October of 89, and then he died in May, right? And I finally, I've been talking to people trying to figure out who it was who told me the rumor that they had heard Julius had died. And I started calling all the people. First I called Peter Gina, I called Renee, I called Ned Sublett, Renee gave me Jerry Eastman's number, and I called him. And some people were dubious because it was not the first time rumors of his death had circulated. I did all the necessary repertorial checking out, and I relied really heavily, actually, on that very famous speech he made before that concert at Northwestern. That was the longest stretch of text that we had to work with and the most revealing. And so I didn't have a lot more recent to work with. One of the big themes of my writing through my life has been minimalism and its history and ramifications. And so I have always, I mean, this is a really eye-opening event today, and this has been a great think tank for getting me to think about these things in various ways. Julius was, in terms of what he did with minimalism, because that was very much, when I knew him, that was something that was very much in the air in the late 70s. And he had done such a brilliant job of picking up the thread and taking it to the next step. These amazing pieces like Gay Gorilla, the one we heard last night, you know, would start off from very clear, simple, minimalist impulses, And then just keep adding pitches until you've got all 12 keys going at once. And this amazing complexity that doesn't seem complex because you felt us getting there all the way. It was a deliciously new wrinkle in that whole thing. And I've always, because of the, I heard him as a performer in other people's music, and I always thought of him in terms of that milieu, the downtown scene of the late 70s and early 80s, and now what we're talking about now, the institutionalization of Julius Eastman, and it's been really interesting today to think of him not as part of a community so much, but exactly what he was doing, and especially to start thinking about what he had to say in that community simply because who he was that no one else was in a position to say.
And because you've been familiar with his music or performing for like 41 years now, has your perception changed at all?
I need to go back and listen to the non-minimalist pieces again, and I'm realizing there are some pieces out there that I don't, that I haven't heard.
Because sometimes, I mean, someone that you like as a, you hear as a freshman in college.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like 40 years later, you have, it's like totally, you've been through so many things that there's a different perception.
I mean,
it could either be worse or better or maybe indifferent or anything. I was just curious because I don't know anybody who's, well, except for people who worked with him in Buffalo.
Yeah. Well, I had a great experience. We had when we first started getting access to the scores and Peter, Gina, and Mary Jane were collecting them, I had a semester at which I was running a new music ensemble at Bard College where I teach, and we have way too many guitarists at Bard. But which worked out well because these piano pieces are supposedly for multiples of any instrument. And I had 9 guitarists in this ensemble. And I looked through the Gay Gorilla score, and it gets up to the point where there are 9 lines going at once. I thought, well, all right, this is just what I need. And so I had to arrange the piece. I knew it for pianos. I had to rethink the whole score into 9 guitar parts, and it was a translation. It did not go easily. I'm a little doubtful about Julius's claim that these pieces were supposed to be for anything but pianos. But the students had a blast doing it. It went very well. And I had to go through all of the complexity of the counterpoint in that piece, and that's the one where the one by one the instruments play "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God," and it echoes from instrument to instrument, and it was a more complex process in the piece than I had realized so many years ago from hearing it. So,
did you tape it?
The student who was supposed to tape it screwed up. I was.
Well, you'll just have to find another 9 guitarists.
Terribly
ensemble.
Chagrined. Oh man, my experience is running an ensemble is not something the world wants repeated. I don't think.
Yeah. Okay, Mary Jane.
Yeah.
How did it feel for you last night? Being at the concert has...
Oh, it was really great. I'd heard the piece live before, but it was really wonderful. I mean, it's always slightly different, and it was fun watching Joe perform because, he knows the music so well. It was really good. But we were talking about something, and we were talking about like the difficulty of transcribing some of the works that there aren't scores for. And we were talking today about how, like, partway through the performance last night, we thought someone was singing. And so you start getting these weird sound phenomena happen, and then all kinds of other sounds, because it really did sound like someone was singing along with it, besides the kind of piano tones that were happening. Yes. And it was kind of fascinating. It was like this like little ghost in the works or something like that. And it just underscores the difficulty of transcribing pieces like that, that where there is no score, because there's all this, you know, what do you do, like have someone like sing along with it so it sounds like that one performance or that performance in Amber that you heard. It's just interesting because every space is different, you know, the acoustics of every space. I'd love to hear this the performance again, maybe with the pianos configured in a different way, just because I love playing around with like sound and space and seeing how the space affects the sound, and because it really does, you know. I do exhaustive studies, like, you know, panning things, and like I'll keep changing the panning of things, and you can get so many fascinating things. I did have an incredible experience in Philadelphia in another rotunda in 1987, and I had this piece for four bass clarinets that was all about sound phenomena that we were just talking about now. And it was a very resonant hall, but all the high partials were disappearing. So we decided to mic it, and it still wasn't really good. And the engineer came up with this brilliant solution, which I recommend to anybody who wants to have more sound. He turned the speakers to the wall. So then they didn't have very far for the sound to travel, so that they could bounce back really quickly. So it reinforced all those upper partials. And it's like such a great trick. Anytime you're in like a dead room or the room is too big, to do something like that. And it's why we all sound great singing in the shower.
Yeah. Speak for yourself.
Well, I don't have a shower. Okay.
So can you talk a little bit, I guess a little bit more in detail about your, like give a kind of overview of
how I got started?
How you see Eastman's music and his some themes that may be consistent throughout his body of work.
Okay, well, I got started in liking his music because I'd heard the piece for 10 cellos, which is still one of my all-time favorite pieces. And then I committed myself to finding enough material for a CD, and then it sort of became like two CDs, and then Kyle had sent Evil Nigger and Gay Gorilla. But you didn't have the third piece.
Right.
And so we contacted
Northwestern,
which New World Records had already been dealing with because they produced The Other Minds, like six CD set or something like that. And they found the tapes, and they were going to digitize them. And the engineer there said, well, he started to play it to see what was on it. No, don't do that. Because one of the things with all these old archival tapes is you have to bake them at like a very low temperature because the emulsion has separated from the plastic. But they finally baked them and digitized them, and then we found that Crazy Nigger was there, and it was like 55 minutes, and the sound quality for all of the pieces was really good. And I actually was surprised at how good, I mean, I knew that he was a good composer, but didn't realize how good he was until all those final pieces kind of fell into place and it put everything into perspective. Because I'd had a lot of the archival recordings from Buffalo, and they were like of uneven quality. I mean, some of them I liked and some of them I didn't like, or the sound quality wasn't good enough to use, or like the tape from the Experimental Intermedia Foundation, which I'm going to send you, was interesting, but not like good enough to put on recording. So my opinion actually improved the more I worked on the project, which is really gratifying. Mm. And it was also really gratifying that people responded to the music and not just to the interesting life story and, you know, because if the music wasn't good, you know, just, you know. It's been a long day. I'm not feeling very articulate at this point. we've been talking since like 8 o'clock this morning. My opinion actually improved, you know, about things. And then when we did Crazy Nigger in The Hague, and that was a really incredible experience. And it was in the City Hall of The Hague, and it's this incredible, like, kind of glass 10-story kind of atrium, and then there's like these balconies all around so people can like go spiraling up, and the acoustics there were fantastic. And about the 30th minute, some of us are going you just get kind of tingly, because in that piece about 30-35 minutes, there's just something magical starts happening. So it's a great experience. Awesome. It's very physical, actually.
One of the things I was just going to say before I left, just so the public is aware, is that in the think tank discussion that we had, that DJ Rupture mentioned, we had a long conversation about propriety and word usage.
Yeah.
Just so you don't think that this is like a casual conversation. And I think all of us in negotiating Julius Eastman's controversial, which he didn't think was controversial, so that's why I'm putting in quote comments, whichever side we felt was appropriate in our opinion came from the position of our love for Julius Eastman and not like a casual relationship to the language. So one of the things that you talked about and that Renee talked about was like that we honor what Julius himself said and articulated what he gave the titles of those pieces to be. Because of my socialization, I can't say certain things. I wasn't raised to say certain things. But I just want to say this because we understand this in our sort of intimate space, that nobody is using any terminology that's racial or queer epithets lightly or without any thought. Might be different positions on who should say what. But, you know, people are coming from a position of deep love and respect for Eastman's work and who he was. And these are people who knew him and loved him mm-hmm. personally. So I just feel like that needs to be said in this public space, yes, because this is an understanding that we have privately about what it means when we're talking about him, and that we have to respect that the public respects him enough to be sensitive mm-hmm. about our usage of certain terms.
Yes, otherwise I might not have spent 17 years tracking all this music.
That's
and
right.
work on
and
it.
It's, yeah. And it's largely due to your, I mean, we have different positions on what we can and cannot say, but I know that if it weren't for what you were doing, none of us would be here,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, or a lot fewer of us would be here, including myself.
Yeah.
So. But anyway, there's a lot to say, and I just wanted to thank everybody for, you know, giving me so much yeah. the last couple of days.